May 22nd, teach them these three little duties. Life is vexing, especially when you're little. As children, we constantly find ourselves in situations for which we have no experience, for which we have not been prepared, for which there does not seem to be a clear or obvious answer. Some of these are big situations, like being bullied or breaking an arm. Some are small, like being nervous to go on your first sleepover or being jealous of something that you wanted that your best friend got instead. Sometimes it's a blessing, sometimes it's a curse of misfortune. How are we supposed to respond? Well, it's your job to show them. Because as disparate and vexing and unique as every moment of life can be, each of us has a set of duties that we can find guidance in any and all situations. You can teach your kids that whatever they're facing, they can respond with hard work, with honesty, and helping others as best they can. It's not always going to lead to success, of course, but it will always lead to something they can be proud of. It will always serve them well, whether it's a sudden reversal or a sudden bounty, whether they're at fault or an innocent bystander. What life demands, what we as their parents are expecting of them, is work, honesty, and compassion. May 23rd. It's better to be kind than clever. There is a story about Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, from when he was a young boy. He was with his grandparents, both of whom were smokers. And Bezos had recently heard an anti-smoking PSA on the radio that explained how many minutes each cigarette takes off a person's lifespan. And so sitting there in the back seat like a typical precocious kid, he put his math skills to work with this new knowledge. And he proudly explained to his grandmother as she puffed away, "You've lost 9 years of your life, Grandma." The typical response to this kind of innocent cheekiness is to pat the child on the head and tell them how smart they are. But Bezos's grandmother didn't do that. Instead, she quite understandably burst into tears. And it was after this exchange that Bezos's grandfather took his grandson aside and taught him a lesson that he says has stuck with him the rest of his life. "Jeff," his grandfather said, "one day you'll understand it's harder to be kind than clever." Cleverness comes easy when you want attention. It takes extra work to be a nice person and patience to reap its rewards. It requires extra effort to stop and think about how what you say and do affects other people. But a truly successful person, a truly great kid, is the result of parents who take time to equip them with this skill. Parents who reward them for their kindness and compassion, not just their intelligence or their grades or their clever tongue. Because these self-absorbed traits, if not balanced with empathy and kindness, can become a wicked and lonely combination. May 24th. Remember this about most people.
No intelligent man believes that anybody ever willingly errs or willingly does base or evil deeds. Socrates.
There are a lot of selfish people out there, cruel people, stupid people, even evil people. And sometimes they're all one person. And your kids are going to meet some of those people. Are they ready? Perhaps a better question is, are you ready? To protect them from the worst of that sort, of course. Also to make sure that your cynicism about the world, about people, does not affect your children too early. There's a great children's book called Most People that reminds us, most people are good. Most people are trying as hard as they can. Most people will help you if they can. Most people want the same things, the book says. Most people are happy. And even the people who aren't, the author reminds us, well, they'd rather be happy if they could. With our life experience, we might struggle to believe that that's true. Regardless, we can't pass on the psychic burden of our own experiences and frustrations, people from our past. And this is the difficult tension we have to resolve as parents. We have to prepare our children for a world that is not all sunshine and kittens. We also have to get them to understand that the darkness of the world is not complete. In fact, it's distinctly the minority. We want our kids to carry the fire to keep the brightness alive. We want them to seek it out in other people. We want them to be like most people, good, kind, happy, helpful. And it's we who will chart that path. May 25th, are you teaching them values?
Any system of education which does not inculcate moral values simply furnishes the intellectual equipment whereby men and women can better satisfy their pride, greed, and lust. Hyman Rickover.
It's true we want them to go to great schools. We want them to learn as much as possible. This is why we monitor their grades. It's why parents are concerned about changes in curriculum, why they save and invest in order to pay for college. But are we really focused on the right things? This isn't just to make the tried and true point that education must give our kids actual job skills they can use out in the world. It's also to question whether our kids are being taught how to be good people at home, in the classroom, and out in the world. Plenty of children go to expensive private schools or make it to the Ivy League, yet they end up being corrupt politicians or soulless business people who devastate industries. Plenty of people learn how to succeed but are deprived of the skills and the decency necessary to manage this success ethically and responsibly. The purpose of education is not to make your kids more selfish, more greedy, more convinced of their own ideas or superiority. No, it's to make them better citizens, better people, and hopefully someday better parents themselves. May 26th, epithets for your kid. One of the most interesting passages in Marcus Aurelius' Meditations is this one. Epithets for yourself: upright, modest, straightforward, sane, cooperative. Try not to exchange them for others, he writes to himself. And these were essentially the words that Marcus wanted to live by, his principles expressed in the fewest syllables possible. But what if, as a parent, you sat down, ideally with your co-parent, and fleshed out what those words would mean for each of your children too? As in, what kind of kid are you trying to raise? What are the watchwords that you are attempting to move them towards with the choices you make as parents? Some obvious ones: kind, loyal, moral, honest. And maybe some more specific ones to help them succeed in the world: creative, bilingual, hardworking, lifelong learner. Maybe to some parents, it's important for their kids to be athletic, for others that they be readers, for others still that their kids lead a life of service. There's a lot of room for choice here, and thankfully, most of the answers you come up with will be right. The important thing is not so much what the epithets are, but that you have chosen at all. For if you don't know what you are aiming for, how can you expect to hit a target? How do you know you're not actually teaching them to exchange one epithet for another? The truth is, you can't. So get to writing. May 27th, the main thing we have to teach them. Michael Schur's fun book of moral philosophy, How to Be Perfect, ends with a meditation on what is one of the toughest jobs for even the wisest and the best of us: how to pass the important lessons of life on to our kids. And one particular passage captures perfectly what those lessons are. You are people on earth, he writes to his kids. You are not alone here. And that means you owe the other people on earth certain things. What you owe them, more or less, is to live by the rules that they wouldn't reject as unfair, assuming they're decent, reasonable people. And he has a great little exercise for his kids to remember too. As you go through life and are thinking about doing something, he says, ask if your brother or sister would think it's a good idea. Then keep going. Ask if a friend would think it was a good idea, or a teacher, or even a kid you don't like but think is smart. Explaining Kant's categorical imperative to a five-year-old, ask, would it be okay if everyone did this? What would the world be like if every single person was allowed to do whatever I'm about to do? The way to raise decent and kind human beings is to teach them how their actions affect other people, what their obligations to other people are. You don't have to be a philosopher to pull that off. Just a good and decent person yourself. May 28th. It's usually not an accident. Florence Nightingale was an incredible woman. She revolutionized nursing. She saved thousands of lives. And this came as a surprise to the high society of Victorian England, because women weren't supposed to do career-type things, let alone something as hands-on as working in a hospital. But anyone who looked at Florence's family tree should not have been surprised. She was not just some saint who came from nowhere. Her great-grandfather was a philanthropist who supported the American Revolution, even donating large chunks of his holdings in Savannah to the cause. His son, Florence's grandfather, was a member of the British House of Commons and a leading abolitionist in the UK. The fact that his daughter, Fanny, Florence's mother, didn't seem to care much about the less fortunate was the exception, not the rule, in their family. It wasn't an accident that Florence Nightingale was inclined to charity and selflessness. She learned it in the fashion that all great traditions are created, from the choices made by family. She was inspired by her ancestors. We can't choose the family tree from which we spring, but as parents, we can choose who in our family tree that we look to for guidance. We can, like Florence Nightingale, pick which family members to be inspired by, whose example to follow. As parents, we can choose which branches of the family tree we tell our kids about, which stories we want to highlight, and which lessons we want to fill their heads with. Raising great, selfless, and courageous kids is not an accident. They aren't sui generis. They don't come from nowhere. They come from tradition. They come from us. May 29th. Always think about how other people are doing. Perhaps you're familiar with the scene in the Bible where Moses, aided by God, parts the Red Sea. It was a miracle of epic proportions that allowed the Israelites to race through and escape the Egyptians who were chasing them. Less known about the miracle is what happened next. When Moses released the sea, the Egyptians were trapped. The water crashes around them and thousands perished. Naturally, the Israelites broke out into song and celebration. As the angels went to join them, though, God rebuked them. And according to the Talmud, he said, "How dare you sing for joy when my creatures are dying?" Whether any of these events actually occurred is beside the point. It doesn't change the lesson. It's easy in the midst of victory and success to think about how wonderful it is for you. It's also easy to forget whom you defeated and what your victory has cost them. It's not unlikely that they've lost more than you've gained. We must be careful to be good sports in this life, to be empathetic and caring enough to realize that things are not always as great for other people as they are for us. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and not let thy heart be glad when he stumbleth, the Bible says in Proverbs 24:17. It's these kinds of ancient and timeless lessons that you must pass along to your children. You can still enjoy what you have, and you should still want to win in life. But don't be so clueless as to think that other people are not suffering. Don't be so self-absorbed as to not care. And don't raise children who are indifferent to either. May 30th. You make debts your children must pay. Nobody wrote more beautifully about the history of conquest and adventure than Theodore Roosevelt. Nobody wrote more poetically about war and glory and empire than Rudyard Kipling. In the end, though, these things left them grieving the sons they had loved so much. Roosevelt lost his son Quentin, shot down over France. Kipling lost his son Jack in the trenches in 1915, so destroyed by shot and shell that they never identified the body. Roosevelt was broken by the loss of his eldest boy and followed him soon to the grave. Kipling, who had written If to his son when he was just 12 years old, would write one of his last poems in grief. Have you news of my boy Jack? Not this tide. When do you think that he'll come back? Not with this wind blowing and this tide. These were tragic, devastating events that no parent should ever have to experience, but it's also indisputable that these two great men were not blameless in their occurrence, not only because the pressure and impossible expectations they put on their children, but because they were part of a generation that had encouraged and celebrated and glibly supported policies that led to the carnage that claimed their sons. And it's a cautionary tale for all parents. Our generation, just like all past generations, makes decisions in the present that have consequences borne primarily by future generations. Our children and grandchildren will live in the world created by your choices, and you yourself may live long enough for that to break your heart. May 31st, A Theory About Life. In the 1930s, languishing in college and struggling to live up to the expectations of his illustrious family, a young Walker Percy wrote a letter to his uncle and adopted father, Will Percy. He probably expected to receive a lecture about his grades in reply, or to be admonished for letting the family down, or perhaps to be sent money for a tutor. But the reply surprised him, because there wasn't any of that. Instead, Will waved off the concerns, telling Walker, "My whole theory about life is that glory and accomplishment are far less important than the creation of character and the individual good life." Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that exactly what every stressed, self-critical, confused kid needs to hear about life? Who you are is more important than what you do. I'd rather you be good than successful. Character is more important than cash. It can be easy to lose sight of this. We all know how competitive the world is, and we see the potential our kids have. We don't want them to make the same mistakes that we do. Ultimately, these things will take care of themselves if we raise them right. The ancients knew that character was fate, and we need to remember that with our own kids. A good life, a life lived well, full of doing good, will be a successful life, and a more important one, too. June. Don't neglect yourself. Lessons in self-care. June 1st. It's okay to ask for help.
Don't be ashamed to need help. Like a soldier storming a wall, you have a mission to accomplish. And if you've been wounded and you need a comrade to pull you up, so what? Marcus Aurelius.
If your kid was struggling, you'd want them to tell you, right? They didn't understand something in class, you'd want them to ask the teacher. If your neighbor needed something, you wouldn't mind if they mentioned it. If your spouse was overwhelmed and needed a hand, you'd expect them to come to you. Okay, but what about you? Are you okay? More important, are you asking for help when you need it, when you are not okay? Remember, we have to model the behavior we want our kids to learn. So if you refuse to ask for directions when you're obviously lost, what does that tell them? If you refuse to admit you don't know something and you make up an answer to a question instead of looking it up with them, what does that show them about learning and problem solving? Why would they be okay being vulnerable with a doctor or a therapist, with mom or dad, if they have been regularly shown that this is something to be ashamed of? But this is about more than that. Even you can't be a good parent if you're hurting and not getting help. You can't be a good parent all by yourself. None of us are islands or invincible or omniscient. To do our best, we have to be able to learn, to rely on others, to admit mistakes, to ask for help. Show them that it is okay to ask for help. Be better for them by asking for the help you know that you need. June 2nd. The most important decision you make.
The most important decision you make is to be in a good mood. Voltaire.
When you're in a bad mood, you know what your kids are thinking? They think it has something to do with them. They don't understand all the responsibility you're shouldering. They don't know about the coworker whose stupidity you had to put up with all day, or your boss's short temper or unrealistic expectations. They can't see the stress that all this stuff puts you under. These are complex emotional issues that are hard for a young kid to understand, especially when the issues are outside their lived experience. So our moods and our choices and the examples we set are affecting our kids always, changing how they see the world and how they see themselves. How we are managing all this stuff makes them feel better or worse, worthwhile or worthless, safe or vulnerable. And in the process, we are creating a pattern for them that becomes hard not to follow, for better or for worse. Your kids are either suffering or benefiting from your moods and emotions. Behave accordingly. June 3rd, transcend this bitter math. When you get married, you give away 50% of your life, the novelist Susan Strait was warned by her mother. What about the other half? A young Susan asked hopefully. When you have a baby, you give away the other half, her mother replied matter-of-factly. Yikes. Yes, marriage and relationships are hard, and in the past, they've been particularly and oppressively cruel to women. For all time, having kids has forced parents to make changes. They deprive us of sleep and money and freedoms we used to take for granted. But does that mean we have to lose ourselves, lose all of our freedom? Absolutely not. We can transcend this bitter math by working on ourselves and our relationships, by asking for help, by refusing to give up on dreams, even as we get older, by focusing on all the things that marriage and kids give us, too, all the experiences we've gained and the opportunities created. To quit on ourselves is to quit on our kids, and it's teaching them a terrible lesson. June 4th, protect your wealth.
The greatest of follies is to sacrifice health for any other kind of happiness. Arthur Schopenhauer.
Of course, our job is to provide for our kids, to work hard, to spend wisely, to save judiciously, to put away some money, if not for their future, then to have the financial wherewithal to make sure their needs are met and our family is protected in case of emergency. But all that work on our financial health will take us only so far if we don't pay similar attention to our mental health. Wealth comes in many forms other than money. Charlemagne the God, a best-selling author and host of the radio show The Breakfast Club, has helped popularize the concept of mental wealth, meaning your sanity, your well-being, your happiness. It's really hard to be a good parent to truly provide when you're stretched way too thin, when you're depressed, when you haven't cultivated the friendships and resources critical to maintaining good mental health. Just as you seek to protect your financial wealth, make sure you are protecting your mental wealth. Don't feel bad spending money on therapy or a book or even deciding to pass on that overtime opportunity because you're just so tired. Your sanity, your clarity, your well-being, these things are essential. It's not selfish to take care of them. It's selfless because your job is to be the best parent you can be. That's going to require a full store of mental wealth. June 5th, you have to take care of yourself too.
When I first began to write, I needed to use the time before they said mama, and that was always around 5 in the morning. Toni Morrison.
One thing too many parents have in common is that they're always putting off taking care of themselves. I'll start going to the gym once they get out of this sleep progression. I'll start eating better once they're less picky about food. My wife and I will get our relationship back on track once the kids move out. This may come from a good place, but the results are good for no one. You have to take care of yourself now. You think your terrible eating habits aren't contributing to your temper? Of course you're grouchy. You feel like a disgusting piece of crap. You think you're doing your kids a favor by shortening your lifespan? You think you're modeling what a good person looks like when you're struggling to get up the stairs or pick up a bag of groceries? You think you're making them feel safe and loved by letting your relationship bleed out on the dining room table? You have to take care of yourself, for them, for you, because you'll be a better parent if you're healthy, happy, and wise. Don't put this off. It's not selfish. It's essential. June 6th. It takes a team. It's impossible to do this all, isn't it? We have all the tasks, responsibilities, and aspirations we've always had. Eating and sleeping, working and paying our taxes and taking out the trash and following our dreams. But now we have little people to care for on top of all that. Little helpless people with infinite needs. How can we do it all? Ursula Le Guin was a full-time writer. She was prolific, publishing 23 novels, 13 children's books, 12 volumes of short stories, 11 volumes of poetry, 5 essay collections, and 4 works of translation. Additionally, she worked as an editor and taught college undergraduate classes. Oh, and she was also the mother of 3 and the wife of a history professor. How does she do it all? How did he do it all? They didn't. One cannot do 2 full-time jobs, she once explained. Writing is a full-time job, and so is children. But 2 people, she said, 2 people can do 3 full-time jobs. That's why I'm so strong on partnerships, she said. It can be a great thing. Parenting is so hard to do alone. So hard. And for too long, too many mothers have had to do it alone. We're forced to sacrifice alone. But of course, we are stronger when we are children's parents parent together. We go farther together. It's one of the only ways to make the math work, not just for the benefit of the children, but the parents as well. June 7th. You need to take this time. Certainly, somebody always needed something. His wife, one of his 13 kids, a messenger, the pressing business of state. But for a few minutes to an hour each day, sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the evening, Marcus Aurelius was unreachable. The 20th century American philosopher Brand Blanchard marvels at what Marcus accomplished there in the midnight dimness, alone with his journal and his thoughts. It didn't matter where he was or what was happening, Marcus stole the time to sit and think and write. Do you? Do you take this time? James Clear, the author of the wonderful bestseller Atomic Habits, said that since becoming a father, he has carved out 2 sacred hours in the morning to do his writing. Sometimes he gets more, but never less. Those 2 hours determine whether he has a good day or a wasted day, whether he is productive and making progress or slacking. A few minutes or a few hours in the morning, at night, or in the middle of the day, the idea of sacred time is important. You have to carve it out. You have to stick to the schedule like clockwork, protect it as you would a doctor's appointment or a big meeting. Of course, this isn't the only time you'll need, it's just the minimum. So make sure you give it or take it for yourself. You'll marvel at what you can accomplish in those few sacred minutes that you've kept all to yourself. June 8th. This is when you are happiest. Before his tragic death, Anthony Bourdain gave an interview where he explained that he was never happier than when I am standing in the backyard like being a TV dad. His life had been so exotic and glamorous before fatherhood, filled with travel and fame and money, and of course, delicious food. But it was also filled with struggle, addiction, depression, loss. But there was something so normal, he said, about just having a normal family, standing in the backyard wearing an apron, flipping burgers. When I find myself doing that, he said, I am like ridiculously stupid happy. It would not be long before Bourdain was found very far from that idyllic backyard on another trip to film another show. That depression, that addiction, they came with him and ultimately took him very finally away from the thing he loved most, his family. It's a sobering reminder to us all, first, to enjoy the present while we have it, Second, to remember how little we actually need to be happy, how wonderful the ordinary moments can be. And third, to understand how quickly it can all be taken away. If you're struggling with addiction, if you're in that dark hole of depression, please just know that as difficult as it is to fight, to break free and climb out, the simple joys and tenderness and compassion you will find in victory with those you love will come with equal ease and ridiculously stupid happiness. June 9th, they need structure, so do you.
If a person puts even one measure of effort into following ritual and the standards of righteousness, he will get back twice as much. Xunzi.
If you talk to a sleep expert about sleep training your infant, they'll tell you that kids need structure and routine. If you talk to an educational expert about helping your kids do better in school, they'll tell you structure and routine. If you talk to a behavioral expert about helping your kid behave, they'll tell you structure and routine. Hell, if you talk to a dog trainer, they'll tell you the same thing about your pet, structure and routine and exercise. Pretty much whatever the problem is, whatever the issue, structure and routine are the solution. Which makes sense, the world is scary. So much of it is new and overwhelming. But if you give them structure and routine, they can relax because they have less to figure out, less to worry about. And they can explore, they can get comfortable and accept things. They can feel safe. But what about you? What about mom and dad? Do you maintain structure and routine for yourself? You put them to bed at the same time every night, but do you wing it after that? You plan their dinners in advance, but what about your lunch at work? You give them quiet playtime in the afternoon and downtime on the weekends, but do you create that kind of regular time for yourself too? Structure and routine are essential no matter who or how old you are. They're important for kids and they're important for parents. Guess what? When you keep a routine for yourself, it's easier to keep them on one too. June 10th. We are all capable of change. Ted Williams was a great baseball player, but for a long time, he was a really selfish and ruthless person. He had a horrible, abusive childhood and struggled to find the ability to love or care about anyone. But Williams's story has enough hope in it to inspire even the most hard-boiled and reluctant of fathers. Because over time, Ted Williams started to change. A friend would say about him, "What's incredible as an observer was to watch him fall in love with his kids. It was everything against his grain to succumb to this outside influence of children. Love had control over him. He felt vulnerable, a vulnerability he never had had in his life. The softness started to show itself in little places, the oddest and yet most personal of places. It was entries in William's fishing journal where he began for the first time to write about the kids he had long ignored. It was a signed poster his daughter found under piles of memorabilia after her father's death that just said, "To my beautiful daughter, I love you, Dad." You have that kind of vulnerability now. Those same powerful forces are gnawing at you too, hopefully, and making progress on that tough exoskeleton you developed to protect yourself from the world. You can let this parenting thing change you. You can let it make you better. You can even begin, no matter how far you are down the road, as Williams was, to make up for mistakes that you might have made early in your parenting days. It's never too late. June 11th. Make sure you make time for crazy. Douglas MacArthur was a man of routine. Most military men are. So it shouldn't surprise us that when his son Arthur was born, he built his family life around routine. But unlike far too many parents who make routine a form of control, MacArthur's morning routine began with a moment of joy. As William Manchester details in his book, American Caesar, it was a kind of scheduled crazy fun. At about 7:30 a.m., the door of the general's bedroom would open, he writes, and the boy would trudge in, clutching his favorite toy. MacArthur would instantly bound out of bed and snap to attention. Then the general marched around the room in quick step while his son counted cadence. Boom, boom, boomity boom. And after they had passed the bed several times, the child would cover his eyes with his hands while MacArthur produced the day's present. A piece of candy, perhaps, or a crayon or a coloring book. And the ritual would end in the bathroom where MacArthur would shave while Arthur watched, and both sang duets. No one is too important or too busy to have some crazy time at home. No one is above getting pummeled by their kid in bed. No father should hesitate before singing at the top of his lungs while he shaves. These moments are the best moments. If they're rare, you're doing them wrong. They should be regular. They should be routine. June 12th. We are all complicated. Naturally, we want to be perfect for our kids, in no small part because the first several years of their lives, to them we can do no wrong, and we want to prove them right. But since we know we are not perfect, inevitably we feel guilty and inadequate when we let them down, even if they're unaware of it at the time. This feeling of insufficiency can be so powerful that we're prone to hiding it or lying about it, or worse, acting like hypocrites. You might think it was devastating for the comedian Pete Davidson, who lost his father on 9/11, to learn that his father was far from perfect. His parents' marriage had not been great, which is why they were separated and divorced not long before that tragic day. His father had done drugs and gotten into trouble more than once in his adult life. As Pete grew older and discovered more and more about his heroic father who died saving people in the collapse of the Twin Towers, he wasn't disappointed, he was heartened. These failings and foibles humanized his father in a way that the stories his friends and family told the then 7-year-old Pete about his dad never could have. It made me realize that he had his own issues, Pete explained to Judd Apatow in Sicker in the Head. He had problems just like everybody else. But it also made me realize that even with all that, his morals were still intact, and none of that prevented him from being a hero. No one is perfect, least of all you. We are all complicated. We are all works in progress. Emphasis, though, on progress. You don't need to hide it. You don't need to feel guilty. It won't prevent you from being great at this most important job, nor from being a hero if the moment calls for it. June 13th. Try not to give them anything extra. We all have issues. We know that. Our goal as parents is to not pass them on, to stop the cycle of dysfunction, to not let the demons we wrestle with find softer targets in our children. But even more than that, we can't let our demons invite new ones to the party. As best we can, we must not inflict more damage or create more issues. This Philip Larkin poem expresses this tendency so perfectly. They fuck you up, your mom and dad, he writes. They may not mean to, but they do. And worse, he says, is that they give us not just their own faults, but some extra ones too. The Buddhists speak of the way that suffering transfers from generation to generation in a cycle. Why is that? Why is it that suffering rarely ever fully discharges from a generation, leaving the next one free to flourish unhindered? It's because we don't do the work. It's because sometimes we are not even aware of our own suffering. And when we are, we still don't do the work. It's often because we tell ourselves we're helpless. Look, we're going to screw up. It's inevitable. We are imperfect people, and it's impossible that we will raise perfect kids. But still, that doesn't mean we are helpless against the demons knocking at our door. We can work on ourselves. We can go to therapy so maybe they won't have to. We can try to be healthy so they'll grow up thinking that that's normal. We can try to move on from our own anger and frustration and pain so that at the very least, they do not inherit our burdens. June 14th. Keep your head up and take another swing.
And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. John Steinbeck.
No person has a perfect track record. Certainly no parent does. We all mess up. We all fall short. We all make mistakes. We lose our temper and our patience. We handle certain situations in ways that we wish we hadn't. Is there anything worse than that feeling, knowing that you screwed up, that you might have hurt them? Shane Parrish, the creator of the wildly popular Farnham Street blog, he explained, "I remember calling my late mom one night, exhausted and feeling overwhelmed. I had lost my cool on the kids. She gave me a piece of advice that stuck with me. If you don't learn how to let go of your mistakes today, they'll compound tomorrow. Go get some sleep and start again tomorrow. I still remember that when I have bad parenting days. Tomorrow, I've got to get up and start all over. You can't go back and undo what you did yesterday. You can't erase from their memories the time you lost your cool or the time you said those regrettable things. But what you can do is make this just one memory among many greater, more positive ones. What you can do is show them that this one moment is not who you are. You can strive to get better. Keep your head up, step up, try again tomorrow. June 15th. This is the secret. When you look at successful people with kids, it can be easy to marvel at all they've accomplished. How did they do it? How did they get it all done? Fortunately, there is an answer, and it's definitely not magic. They have help. They have nannies and tutors and house managers. They have chiefs of staff. They have personal assistants. They have personal trainers. That's how they get it all done. If you could afford it, you'd be just as efficient and seemingly carefree as them. Now, the point of explaining this is not to make you jealous or to point out the inequities of society. In fact, it's the opposite. It's to nudge you into following in their footsteps. Of course, hiring full-time staff is beyond most of our capabilities, but surely there are things that you are doing that you don't have to do that you could afford to pay someone to do for you. And yet you continue to do them. Why? Because your dad changed the oil in his car? Because your mom always served home-cooked meals? Because you feel guilty outsourcing this or that? Come on, forget the gender roles. Forget the way things used to be. The way things used to be almost invariably involved parents spending way, way less time with their kids than we do now. Take a minute today and calculate what an hour of your time is worth. Think about how much more present you would be for your kids if there was less on your plate. You don't have to outsource everything, hire help for everything, but you don't have to do everything yourself either. Get help. June 16th, do as you say. It was an ordinary day that Jimmy Carter's father pulled his son aside for a conversation. Jimmy, he said, and he never called his son Jimmy, I need to talk to you about something important. Yes, sir, Daddy, Jimmy replied. There's something I want you to promise me. His father continued, I don't want you to smoke a cigarette until you're 21 years old. This was in the late 1930s when something like 40% of the population smoked and cigarettes could still be marketed to children with advertisements that made claims like more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. And Carter's dad himself was hopelessly hooked. I won't, Jimmy promised. And then his father sweetened the deal. When the time comes, I'll give you a gold watch. When he was 21 years old, then in the Naval Academy, young Jimmy Carter finally tried smoking. By then, it was too late. He'd missed his window and he hated it, and he never smoked another. But tragically, Carter's mother and three of his siblings followed in his father's footsteps. Each one of them died of pancreatic cancer, and Carter lived to be nearly 100. When it comes to the important things with lifelong implications, you have to make them promise, as Carter's father did. But you also have to learn from his failure and lead by example. The costs of not doing it could be everything. June 17th. Find your people.
Keep company only with people who uplift you, whose presence calls forth your best. Epictetus.
Michael Chabon was worried about his son, as all fathers worry. His son seemed lonely, seemed uninterested in the things his peers liked. And then one day they found themselves at some sort of fashion industry event as part of his work as an author, and his son was fascinated. These creative and artistic people were so unlike the parents of his friends and the kids at his school. He came alive with a kind of infectious excitement that was reciprocated kindly by all the other attendees. And after the event, Chabon looked at his son, who seemed suddenly possessed of a confidence and purpose that he didn't have before. You were with your people, he said to him. You found them. And his son nodded. With both pride and understanding, all Chabon could say was, that's good. You're early. We need to help our kids find their people. But nothing would benefit us more than doing the same. The ancient proverb is, if you dwell with a lame man, you will learn how to limp. We become like the people we spend the most time with. The random people you went to school with or met through work or your kids' friends' parents, don't settle. Find your people. Lean on their support. Let them make you a better parent. June 18th. All that matters is this. Flea, one of the greatest musicians of all time, was a lifelong dabbler in drugs and alcohol. Unlike his Red Hot Chili Pepper bandmates, Flea never got fully strung out. Drugs never blew up his life or turned him into a zombie. He knew it wasn't healthy, but he told himself he was managing the habit successfully, never taking drugs around his kids or blowing opportunities because of them. So why did he suddenly get sober? He explained it in an interview with the comedian and podcaster Marc Maron. I remember having a talk with someone once about being a dad, he said, and my daughter was about 4 years old or something, and I would get high when I was away from her. Oh, I don't do it when I'm around her, I said. And they said, all that matters as a parent is to be present for your kid and be communicative. And you have to be communicating with them when you're not around them. You have to be. It's like being in a state where you're always there for them. Like your spirit is always available whenever they need you, Flea explained. And that really resonated with me. And I love my kids so much. And I was like, that's it. I got to be there. Presence, being there. This is the key to parenting. And what are drugs and addiction and unaddressed issues in our lives but means of not being there? Which is why we have to sober up and deal with our demons. Because even if they don't feel like they're actively manifesting themselves at home, they are. They are taking us away from our kids. They are putting us in positions to not be there for them when they need us. And they will need us. And that kind of self-inflicted disconnection is unacceptable. June 19th. You must find the stillness.
All profound things and emotions of things are preceded and attended by silence. Silence is the general consecration of the universe. Herman Melville.
This change we've made, this decision to become a parent, it has uprooted everything. It's like we were hit suddenly by a crossfire hurricane. The house is a mess, the schedule is grueling. There is never enough sleep, never enough time in the day. Even the cool, quiet dark is pierced by the shriek of a man who has stepped on a pile of Legos, and the shriek is coming from your mouth. Yet to be good at our jobs, to be good at this parenting thing, we must endeavor to find stillness, because we need time to reflect, to focus, to find the calm that will restore and reboot us. Where will we find it? It won't be in those 2 measly weeks of vacation or by cutting and running and fleeing. No, we must find the stillness within the chaos. It might not feel like these moments of quiet can exist with all the crying babies or arguing teenagers, but they can. If we just look within, we can find the stillness if we take advantage of the early morning before the house is awake or those precious minutes after the kids are in bed. But we really have to drink in those moments to get the most from them. We can't defer these chances in favor of our phones or Netflix. We must take time with a journal. We must enjoy that cute but preposterously slow walk from school to the car or from the car back into the house. Soak up the quiet. Store those moments in your soul so you can have them always. Find the stillness. So much depends on it. June 20th, access the child in you. The darkness of World War II raged around him. He was an old man with a million important concerns. He had power and success. He had seen it all. But in 1944, when Winston Churchill came across a young soldier at 10 Downing Street assembling a toy train for Churchill's grandson, he was transfixed. As Eric Larson describes in his fascinating book, The Splendid and the Vile, the soldier stopped to salute the prime minister. Churchill waved it away and simply stood watching. After the soldier had finished, Churchill asked him to see if it worked, and together they watched the train go round the track. "I see you have two engines," he said. "Put the other one on the track as well." The soldier did as he was instructed, and then Churchill, leader of the British Empire, a man who had stared down Hitler and pulled his country back from the brink, got down on his hands and knees with a grin and said, "Now let's have a crash." One of the most wonderful things about having a kids and grandkids is that they allow us to access that childlike part of ourselves that never fully goes away. They give us an excuse to get down on the floor and crash two trains together, to build something cool with Legos, to dress up for Halloween, to be silly at a tea party, to listen to the music of our youth, to watch the movies we loved. It's more than a fun excuse. It is an important part of life. Don't forget to access that joy and fun. And maybe, you know, invite your kids to join you in it. June 21st. It's good that you worry about this.
One great thing about having kids is that they force you into an active practice of love, whether you are ready for it or not. Michael Ian Black.
The question hits you in a soft place. It hits you when you least expect it, and yet it is there constantly. Am I a good parent? Am I screwing this thing up? Your own parents will try to reassure you. Every parent thinks that, they'll say, except that's not true. There are, in fact, two types of parents who never think that. There are the parents who are so convinced that they're the center of the universe that they never question themselves, never wonder what they're doing wrong. And then there are the parents who don't even care enough to ask. And although these parents are very different, in the end, the two types are the same. They're not good parents. But you? The type who is always checking in and wondering, am I doing enough? Who actually cares about whether you're doing a good job? You are, by definition, a good parent because you are thinking about your kids first and not yourself. It's proof that you care, that you have self-awareness, that you are always trying to improve, that you would stop to try to evaluate your own performance, that it would bother you to give anything less than the full measure of your devotion. It's all the evidence you need to reach a positive conclusion to this question. So if you feel that negative thought, that doubt, if you feel it come up today, be reassured. It means you're putting them first. It means you're doing a good job. June 22nd. Just go to bed.
Sleep is the interest we have to pay on the capital which is called in at death. The higher the interest rate, and the more regularly it is paid, the further the date of redemption is postponed. Arthur Schopenhauer.
You know your kids are a mess when they don't sleep. That's why you follow the bedtime ritual religiously. You know that your kids get into trouble at night if left to their own devices, and that's why your teenager has a curfew that you enforce with an iron fist. And yet here you are, up late again, mindlessly watching TV. Here you are, tired in the morning again, because you were up late on your phone. You could have gone to bed. You knew you should have gone to bed, but you didn't. And who suffers? Your kids do. Because you're grouchy. Because you don't have energy. Because you're behind. Because maybe they even sense that you're a hypocrite. If you want to be a better parent, start going to bed earlier. Give yourself a bedtime that you honor and respect and enforce. Value sleep. Take care of yourself. Everyone in your family will benefit. June 23rd. This has made you invincible. Parenting, like exercise, is a process of growth through pain, through struggle against resistance. It would have been wonderful if raising kids were easy, if it demanded little of you, but that's just not how it works. We've been sleep deprived. We've been worried. We've been bitten and kicked. We've been judged. We've been leaned on and taken for granted, kept up late by infants, and then by missed curfews. We've been blamed and bothered and bludgeoned by and for their wants and needs. It is a gauntlet in a crucible through a minefield with no trophy at the end. And yet, here we are. By necessity, we have become capable of things we never could have conceived of for ourselves before. It was Leonardo da Vinci who said that patience was bitter, but its fruit was sweet. And this holds true for many of the virtues that parenting has demanded we embody. We've been patient, we've been resilient, we've been brave, we've been selfless, self-effacing, steadfast, and silent, none of which were particularly fun at the time. But the result was that we grew stronger for it. Our families survived and thrived because of it. They are where they are right now because of how far we've come as parents. And there is no trophy on the other side of that parenting minefield, but there is a happy, healthy, bonded family, and that prize is the sweetest of them all. June 24th. Just pick yourself back up. Maybe lately you haven't been as good of a parent as you would like to be. You were on your phone too much. You let your short temper get the best of you. You prioritized work over family. You got too wrapped up in your expectations. You were too harsh. You refused to see things their way. Well, that's all in the past. It happened. It shouldn't have, but it did. And there's nothing you can do to undo it. And so the question is, now what? We have the power at any moment to get back on track. We can choose always to return to the standard we want to live up to as parents. It's like with a diet. You can slip a little, then a little more. Then the next thing you know, you've eaten a whole sleeve of Oreos. Okay, that happened, but tomorrow hasn't yet. You have a choice. Will you do better? Will you do what you know is right? Will you follow the plan you set for yourself before the Oreo debacle? No parent has time to indulge themselves in pity parties, nor can any parent justify a continued slide. We screw up, we fall short, we're not what we want to be, what we promised ourselves we would be, what we owe our kids, and you can choose right now to get back on track. We can choose right now to do better. June 25th. You would tell them this, so tell yourself too.
But I couldn't speak my dream without a caveat. I don't know, I said. By the time I finish school, I'll be 50. He smiled at me. You're going to be 50 anyhow, he said. Dr. Edith Egger.
It's hard to imagine any situation that you would describe to your kid as hopeless. Sorry, it's too late, you're a failure, is something no parent would ever say to their kid. If they were falling behind their peers in math, you'd tell them that it was just a matter of work and time. If they were trying to write themselves off as a baseball player, you'd tell them how many athletes were late bloomers, that they're still so young that next year they can come back stronger and better, that they can turn things around. Even if they had a cancer diagnosis with terrible odds, you'd be encouraging them to fight, to never give up, to prove the doubters wrong. You wouldn't just be saying this either. You'd mean it, because it's true. Nothing is fixed in this life that you haven't fixed yourself. Nothing is permanent, especially when the person deep down is good and decent and full of potential. Okay, so why are you whispering the exact opposite of this to yourself? Telling yourself that you've got to accept that your dreams are done. Telling yourself, I used to be in good shape, but that's in the past. No, it's never too late. You still have so much time in front of you, so much ability, so much potential to fulfill. You decide the rest of the story. It's up to you. But this is the important part. The story that you decide for yourself is also going to determine what kind of stories your kids tell themselves, what kind of story they believe. Your story is the compass and the map on the journey that will lead them to realism optimism, skepticism, cynicism, or fatalism? Which will it be? June 26th. You have to face your flaws. Each of us has picked up things in childhood. We have issues, we have baggage, we have flaws. And the decision to have kids means that we have to face those flaws. As Jessica Leahy, the wonderful author of The Gift of Failure, great book for parents and teachers, as she said when she was asked what she learned about being a mother, she said, having to face the flaws I thought I could keep secret and buried from the world because I wanted to be better for this new person. She said, the flaws in me I've been so good at hiding through excelling academically or being charismatic, they start to poke through because it matters to someone other than me. She said, for me, those flaws are defensiveness around my potential flaws, my tendency to disconnect, be distracted from whatever is happening right in front of me in favor of whatever is next. And notably, she said, substance abuse. If I'd never had children, I probably could have kept that stuff buried, but parenthood demanded that I deal with it in order to model a healthy, loving, productive humanity to my kids. If you want to be a great parent, you're going to have to deal with your crap. You can't carry baggage. It's too dangerous with your kid around. You risk dropping it on them. There can be no more hiding, no more deferring. The bill is due and you have to pay it in therapy, in conversations with your spouse, in the pages of your journal. You have to face your flaws because there are little people who did not choose to be stuck in the same house with you and should not have to be trapped with a monster or a brick wall for a parent. June 27th. Don't get sick.
If you want to find something mean on the internet, you're going to find it. Judd Apatow.
There's a great term floating out there in the culture that describes what happens when we spend too much time on our phone. Whether it's adult doom scrolling or a kid going down a YouTube unboxing rabbit hole, when you spend too much time staring at your device, you get screen sick. You know that insane reaction your kids get when you suddenly turn off the TV? Their catatonic state when they've locked into some video game, when the walls could be falling down around them and they wouldn't even blink? The fantasy world that your teenager comes to mistake for reality after too many hours on the computer in their room. And you know the symptoms. You're grouchy and you hate humanity after seeing too much of its underbelly on social media. You can't pay attention to anything but your email. The phantom vibrations of your phone haunt you like a ghost. Well, the good news is that this is a pretty easy illness to cure. A phone-free day can cure it. Going outside for a couple hours can refocus your mind and reset your spirit. The bad news is, the people who have made your phone and everything that goes on it know that there's an easy fix too, which is why they've spent so much time and energy and money engineering ways to keep you connected to it, addicted to it, beholden to it. And you have to fight that. You can't let the technology use you. You have to be the one using the technology. It's the only way to have a healthy relationship with your phone and to avoid the screen sickness that infects us. June 28th, delight in attending to your own improvement. It's a sad sight when you see a dad who has clearly stopped trying. He puts on weight. He checks out of his marriage. Maybe he starts drinking more. He resigns himself to the fact that he hates his job. He accepts whatever grades his kids bring home from school. He makes their behavior somebody else's problem. We see that parent and we think, I never want to be that guy. Good. Okay. But what steps are you taking to ensure that you don't? In the startup world, they say that if your company isn't growing, it's dying. In a way, it's sort of true for people too. If you're not actively developing yourself, what's happening? You're atrophying. You're getting worse. Entropy is winning. Epictetus liked to quote Socrates, who said that he delighted in attending his own improvement day to day. Brilliant. It's the perfect thing for you to think about. How are you improving yourself day to day? Are you working out? Are you reading? Are you setting goals for yourself? Are you clocking in at home as well as at the office? Your kids will be better served by a parent who is getting better. More important, they will be inspired by your example. Show them that you're trying, that we can never stop trying, and they'll follow you in their own way. June 29th. It's not over for you. Susan Strait had been helping her mother move when she found an old painting thrown in a trash can. Sensing that it wasn't something her mother had bought, she asked about it. "I took a painting class at the YMCA," Strait recalled her mother explaining. "Then I found a book, Teach Yourself to Paint." Strait recalls, "My mother was an artist. She made beautiful sketches of our garden and our house in Switzerland." Surprised and moved, they began to talk about the painting. Was this a secret hobby that Susan had never known about? Did her mother have a creative side that she never shared? Were there other paintings? Sadly, no. "Just after I finished this," her mother stated matter-of-factly, "I had you, and then I never painted anything again. My life was over." Ouch. Yet there is some part of us that understands this sentiment, right? A part of us that felt like when our house was suddenly flooded with babies and diapers and our routines were disrupted by carpools and soccer practices, life was over. Or at least the fun and free and good life. No more time for hobbies, no more energy for self-exploration, let alone self-actualization. And certainly we have been taxed and burdened in a way that we never expected. But we can't throw in the towel. We can't use being a parent as an excuse. On the contrary, because our kids are watching us, we have to keep pushing ourselves. We have to transcend this bitter math. We have to keep growing. We can't give up on ourselves and our interests. Our lives are not over, not even close. In a way, they are just beginning. June 30th. Here's how you can help other parents. There is the professional you and the parental you. It makes sense that we try to keep these things pretty distinct and separate. We even have a name for this distinction. We call it boundaries and work-life balance. And it's good that we try to leave our work at the office when we head home. But one way we can help other parents or prospective parents is by making sure that we don't leave our kids at home, figuratively, anyway. By talking about our kids, by putting pictures of them up on our walls, by being honest and upfront about trying to balance our careers and families, we are all helping each other. For too long, parents have struggled in silence. They've been overwhelmed or burned out. They've wrestled with priorities. They've worried. They've hurt. They've wondered what the hell they're going to do. They've done this all alone, even as the person in the office next to them was going through the same hell, even as the boss was wondering the exact same thing about their kids. We can all help each other if we end this charade. We can help the parents we work with by creating an environment that's open and safe that allows us to stop pretending that we aren't all trying to work two jobs at the same time and trying to work them well. July. Help them become who they are. Lessons in nurturing and discovery. July 1. Is it nature or nurture? Plutarch tells the story of a Spartan reformer who took Sparta from rebellious and rowdy and soft to self-disciplined, temperate, and courageous. The man bred two dogs from the same litter, then raised one in the home and one out in the hunting fields. When they were fully acclimated, he brought both dogs to a public assembly. He set down the house dog's food and then the hunting dog's. Before he released the dogs, he let loose a rabbit. The house dog went to his food. The hunting dog went after the hare. "You see, my fellow citizens," he said, "these dogs belong to the same stock, but by virtue of the discipline to which they have both been subjected, they have turned out utterly different from each other. And you also see how training is more effective than nature for good." After his demonstrations proved that nature trumped nurture, the man said, "So also in our case, fellow citizens, noble birth, so admired of the multitude, and our being descended from Hercules does not bestow any advantage. unless we do the sort of things for which he was manifestly the most glorious and most noble of all mankind, and unless we practice and learn what is good our whole life long. So it goes for our own family. If we want great kids, we have to do the work. We have to nurture the traits we want them to have and correct the ones we don't. July 2nd, help them become who they are.
A lot of parents will do anything for their kids, except let them be themselves. Banksy.
In his autobiography, Bruce Springsteen takes us back to when he was 7 years old when he watched Elvis Presley's appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I sat there transfixed in front of the television set, my mind on fire, he said. I had the same two arms, two legs, two eyes. I looked hideous, but I'd figure that part out. So what was missing? The guitar. The next day, I convinced my mom to take me to Deal's Music on South Street in Freehold. There, with no money to spend, we rented a guitar. Our job as parents is not to mold our children into our successors or into superstars. It's to help them be what they are meant to become. We expose them to things. We let them find what interests them, and then we support those interests. We shouldn't pressure. We shouldn't criticize. We should believe in them, cheer for them, be proud of them, and be ready to catch them if they fall or fail on the path to becoming who they are meant to be. July 3rd. You have to help them discover this. Almost every talented and successful person can remember their introduction to whatever it was that became their thing. In Mastery, Robert Greene explores countless examples of this beautiful process by which some of the world's most notable experts discovered their life's task. He talks about Martha Graham's first time watching a dance performance, for instance, and he tells the story of the compass that Albert Einstein's father gave him as a present when he was 5 years old. Instantly, the boy was transfixed by the needle, Robert writes, which changed direction as the compass moved about. The idea that there was some kind of magnetic force that operated on this needle, invisible to the eyes, touched him to the core. At the core of most of these stories are a few key ingredients: luck, openness, curiosity, and of course, often a parent who actively expose their kid to different things. It's your child's job to figure out what they want to do in life. No parent can or should make their children master anything. But it is your job, especially when they're young, open their eyes, to introduce serendipity into the equation, to expose them to all the possibilities that life has to offer. Show them what's out there. Help them discover. July 4th, don't tie down your ego. When a young Florence Nightingale began making moves towards volunteering in hospitals, her aristocratic parents were horrified. It had been difficult enough raising a precocious child. Now she wanted to debase herself with work below her station? They were embarrassed. What would their friends think? How would it look? Like a lot of parents with determined, independent children, they felt rejected. They thought her choices rebuked theirs. We are ducks who have hatched a wild swan, her mother once lamented. But a biographer responded perfectly. It was not a swan they had hatched, she wrote. It was an eagle. You can't hold your children back. You can't resent that they're different. You can't hold them back with antiquated notions about gender or class. Their choices say nothing about your choices. They are their own people. They deserve their own lives. They deserve your support and encouragement in whatever direction that takes them or you. That's what we're here for, and we can't forget it. July 5th, ask if they'd like to learn. Arthur Ashe became a brilliant tennis player and an ardent civil rights activist because of a question. He was 7 years old and sitting in a park in Richmond, Virginia, watching an accomplished black tennis player named Ron Charity practice. Ash's father was a park supervisor and often left his son to entertain himself while he worked. After about an hour, Ron Charity took a break and walked over to the boy. "Would you like to learn how to play?" he asked kindly. And with that simple, generous question, Ash and the game of tennis were changed forever. As casually as that, Ash reflected, my life was transformed. And how many lives have been transformed in a similar way? Because an adult took the time to notice the interests of a child, had the patience to introduce them to something, was willing to teach them a skill or a trade. Of course, we cannot rely solely on the kindness of strangers. It's our job as parents to take the time to do this for our kids. We have to cultivate that flicker of curiosity into full-blown love affairs. We have to channel their energy into productive pursuits. We have to teach them about stuff, especially the things they're too afraid to ask about or don't even know to ask about. Often, that's where the magic resides. July 6th. You have to do this. We need it.
I think that the major obligation of parents and educators is to give children an understanding of the divine beginning that exists within them. William Ellery Channing.
Cormac McCarthy talks about carrying the fire in his haunting novel, The Road, which he wrote for his son. Alanis Morissette put her own spin on it in her beautiful song, Ablaze, which she wrote for her two children. To my girl, she sings, all your innocence and fire. My mission is to keep the light in your eyes ablaze. And to her son, whom she calls her precious, gentle warrior, with all his wild energy, she sings the same thing. Our job is to keep our kids the way they were when they were born, which, as The Road was written to show us, means fundamentally good, innocent, and pure. We have to help them carry the fire. We have to keep that light in their eyes ablaze, no matter how dark the world gets. In fact, we have to do it now more than ever because the world is dark. That's our job. That's our warrant. If we fail, God help us. July 7th. Your kid will be whatever you make them. The Holocaust survivor turns psychologist and author, Dr. Edith Egger, had a son who was born with athetoid cerebral palsy. One day, on a visit to the doctor's office, Dr. Egger expressed some of her fears and worries to the specialist, and it was there that she got some advice that is worth sharing with every parent, whether your family has ever had to face this kind of adversity or not. Your son will be whatever you make of him, the doctor explained. John's going to do everything everyone else does, but it's going to take him longer to get there. You can push him too hard, and that will backfire, but it will also be a mistake not to push him hard enough. You need to push him to the level of his potential. Your kids will be whatever you make them. No one is saying that things won't be hard. No one is saying that any of this is fair. Dyslexia or disabilities, being a refugee or losing your job, being a genius or short. What matters is how we push them and push ourselves. What matters is the kindness and love and the patience that accompany that pushing. We can't do everything for them, but we can believe in them and help them believe in themselves. We can help them reach their level of potential. We can make them be what they are capable of being.